Council, and please take a seat. I'll have the marshal call the second matter on today's calendar, and then I'll have a few remarks before we begin.
Calling A241458, Karen Denny petitioner respondent versus Ricky Denny appellant.
So welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the second matter on our oral argument calendar. I see counsel are here and present. I'll make just a few quick remarks. I know you're familiar with our procedures. If you have questions, I know you'll ask them. When you approach the podium, I just want to remind you of a couple of things. Take your time to get comfortable and adjust the height as well as the microphone. We would like to capture all of your remarks. You're probably aware. So this is being made available via Zoom live. And then there is an audio recording that's maintained and put on the court's website. So we like to have our record clear. That means that we ask you to identify yourself as well as the client you represent before you start your argument. With that, you know, the time for our argument tends to go quickly. It should be visible to you at the podium. We look forward to the conversation, but please keep an eye on the clock. So with that, counsel for appellant, when you're ready, please go ahead and begin.
Mm-hmm. May it please the court, counsel. This is an appeal of a lopsided marital asset distribution. The trial court.
Counsel, you're going to identify.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Thank you,
Your Honor. I know you meant to.
Your Honor, thank you. John Lesch, L-E-S-C-H, counsel for appellant Rick Denny. Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, this is an appeal of a lopsided marital asset distribution. The trial court, in this instance, knew that it was a lopsided distribution. It even admitted so using the word lopsided in its order. Its excuse for this was that it simply had no other recourse due to appellant husband's failures to disclose evidence, and that it had no way to determine the extent of the lopsidedness of its own decision because appellant had not disclosed this evidence on time. And that's just not true. The court made its decision on the eve of trial that it would actively exclude evidence of equity in appellant husband's home, and it made the decision that it would exclude any testimony that related to that evidence. Now, the court also knew that this evidence had been discussed between the parties at mediation months earlier. So it knew the parties were aware of this evidence.
What does that mean? Does that mean that it knew that wife had the exhibits that you were proposing?
Your Honor, according to the court, according to the transcript, it was aware that this information had been exchanged. But trial counsel for appellant stated that the documents had not necessarily been exchanged.
So the record doesn't show that wife had the documents.
That is correct, Your
okay.
Honor.
Okay. When and the documents are those that are in exhibits, I forget the numbers.
205 and 206, Your
205
Honor.
And 206. When were those exhibits provided to wife?
They were provided on the eve of trial, Your Honor.
On the eve of trial. Okay. So clearly not provided in discovery despite the orders. I think two orders that ordered their disclosure. And then the exhibits are provided on the eve of trial. What is the abuse of discretion in excluding those under as a discovery sanction?
Your Honor, the abuse of discretion is viewed through the totality of the circumstances. So if, for example, the penalty for the exclusion of those assets was commensurate to what should be awarded to wife for what was a failure of appellant to disclose, that would be reasonable. But in this instance, we're looking at what ended up to be an award of $87,000 because of the exclusion of those that evidence. That is extraordinary. That is a really high penalty, and that is why we're claiming that discretion was abused in this instance.
So, I mean, the exclusion, obviously, of evidence that's proposed as a sanction for a discovery violation can do harm. I mean, presumably the evidence is in there for a reason. So it's not that exclusion can do no harm. You're just saying the harm was too big.
Yes, Your
essentially.
Honor. Yes, yes. And we're conceding, we're not disputing the fact that the trial court has the right to impose at its, you know, in its toolkit, various penalties for failure to disclose. And the record suggests that appellant failed to disclose. But because this resulted in such a high award, that is what we're stating is the abuse of discretion. And it's what compounded the penalty. Now, here, we are stating that this abuse of discretion is coupled with the award of attorney's fees of $10,000. Another remedy that is available to the trial court for it should be tied to the harm to respondent on that, and we're also claiming it was not tied to it, but you know, $10,000 may well be in the ballpark. But it is compounded when you add to this that there was the $87,000 cost related to the exclusion of Exhibits 205 and 206, and further, the exclusion of the encumbrance for the 2021 Chevy Silverado. That was a pickup truck that was awarded to appellant husband. The parties expected it would be awarded to him. It was awarded to him. There was no disagreement regarding the value of the truck, but the trial court summarily decided that there was no encumbrance on that.
It didn't exclude documentary evidence of an encumbrance, did it?
No.
It didn't credit husband's, I think it's around $40,000 left.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And Your Honor, I would say this. There's no question that a trial court has the ability to determine credibility of testifiers, of the parties. But in this case, there was no dispute as to the statement of appellant about that it was about $40,000. Yes, it was imprecise, but wife did not say, no, it's a $20,000 encumbrance or a $15,000 encumbrance. Further, a 2021 pickup truck that both parties agree on the value of about $51,000, it can fairly be inferred and construed that the remaining encumbrance is about $40,000. There was no evidence introduced by wife that marital assets were used to purchase this pickup truck free and clear. Therefore, it should be inferred that an encumbrance was on the vehicle. Husband testified that it was about $40,000. Yes, it was imprecise, but wife did not dispute it. Trial court said, no, there is no encumbrance because he said it was $40,000 and I don't see a validation. The other problem that is created with this is that the trial court did not impose upon respondent wife the same standards that she did upon husband. And again, we're not talking about credibility here. The trial court did not require wife to corroborate her credit card debt incurred during the marriage was marital debt. It is within the trial court's discretion to do that. It also did not.
I don't really understand the. What's your argument that it was not marital debt? Obviously marital debt can include clothing that a spouse buys for themselves. What made it non-marital? It seems like you both employ an idea of it becoming non-marital somehow. Debt versus it being dissipation of assets, which are two different things. Dissipation applies to dissipating marital assets. So explain to me, I don't really see the argument that it satisfies, I don't see you making the argument that the evidence satisfies a dissipation standard, which is an anticipation of divorce, I dissipated assets. So explain to me which one you're arguing that.
Your Honor, I would say that this argument is more of a footnote to the first two. If we came before Your Honors simply arguing the credit card debt and the $23,000 in student loans as marital debt, it would admittedly be a weaker argument. Okay. However, when you compare that to the requirements that the trial court imposed upon appellant husband for corroboration of the equity in the homes and in the truck, you see what we are arguing is the abuse of discretion. So we understand and expect that that the argument before the Court of Appeals is not necessarily great on the marital debt, but it shows how the first two pieces are abuse of discretion. I hope that answers your question.
Does the district court abuse its discretion if it holds parties to different obligations to substantiate testimonial facts? If one of the parties has engaged in a failure to disclose, failure to provide discovery?
Well, Your Honor, what I would argue is this, is that the answer to that is yes, only to the extent that if there is a decision against the logic and the facts on the record. So if it is limited exclusively to who's telling the truth, there is no abuse of discretion.
No, I was getting to you were suggesting a double standard that the district court applied to one party and not the other, expecting corroboration, documentary corroboration for statements made under oath. And I'm wondering whether you believe the district court abuses its discretion if it, in fact, applies a different standard to the two parties with regard to corroborating evidence, if the district court has some basis to be concerned about the credibility of one, not the other.
Your Honor, I would say not necessarily, except, however, the behavior of appellant husband in failing to produce on time is not an indicator of untruthfulness. And whether it was due to his actions or the actions of his attorney, it should not be construed against him as a credibility question. I would also note that the $10,000 in conduct-based attorney's fees is also something that is within the court's discretion, but the court is required to tie that to what he did that created costs for appellant, and that wasn't done by the trial court in any instance here. I would also say, Your Honor, that aside from this being a decision that went against the weight of the evidence and was against the facts on the record, the district court is indeed required to establish that a party claiming a non-marital interest has to prove the necessary facts by a preponderance of the evidence of the non-marital nature of the asset. And in this case, they didn't do that at all. The way that the district court skirted that is by saying, we're just going to act like these encumbrances, the encumbrance on the truck and the encumbrance as well as the equity in the two homes just simply don't exist.
How does that relate to non-marital? I thought the district court was allocating marital assets, and it considered essentially the houses both to be marital assets, that it allocated one to one to the other, and didn't recognize, based on the exclusion of evidence, the equity in one. But it didn't conclude, or did it, that there something was non-marital?
Your Honor, it did not make an express conclusion that that was non-marital, but that was the effect that it had by ignoring the equity and the valuations of those properties. That is our argument. That is the impact. Okay. So that is all I have, unless there are other questions.
No. Doesn't appear so at this time, counsel. So you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Michaela Wattenbarger, W-A-T-T-E-N-B-A-R-G-E-R, and I am appearing on behalf of the respondent, Karen Denny. This case revolves primarily around the district court's discretion to impose discovery sanctions and order attorney's fees in a divorce action involving property division. In this case, the district court did not abuse its discretion in imposing the discovery sanctions that it imposed in excluding evidence from trial and awarding conduct-based attorney's fees specifically, and in dividing the party's property based on the evidence that was received at trial. Accordingly, respondent is asking that this court affirm the district court's order in its entirety. First, with respect to the district court's exclusion of evidence regarding appellant's home equity, as an initial matter, it's given that this is an evidentiary ruling, it's not entirely clear to me that this issue was properly preserved for appeal, given that there was no motion for a new trial filed with respect to the court's evidentiary ruling on the motion in limine that respondent filed and on which the court ruled and granted.
Did you make this argument in your brief?
I do not believe that that argument was included in the brief. If it was properly preserved for appeal, respondent would submit, again, that the district court did not abuse its discretion by barring appellant from presenting evidence of his home equity. And specifically, as discussed by appellant's attorney, the district court excluded two of appellant's exhibits. Exhibit 205 and 206, which were a settlement statement and a mortgage statement for appellant's home. And these were among documents that were specifically sought by respondent as part of the discovery process. First, as an agreed-upon exchange of disclosures as part of a binding mediated agreement, and then through the formal discovery process.
So why isn't it too big a sanction? I mean, it's very significant. I don't know that there's a challenge to the veracity of those documents or a suggestion that he could have paid for that house outright. Why isn't it just an abuse of discretion? Not because sanctions weren't deserved, but because it's just too much.
Minnesota courts have taken into account availability of other sanctions, the size, the scope of the sanction in looking at whether a discovery sanction is appropriate. In this case, the discovery sanction respondent would submit was narrowly tailored to the behavior that was being responded to by the district.
That's the type of sanction. I think Judge Smith's question that I'd like you to explore further regards the amount, not the type of sanction. Why was the amount within the court's discretion?
Well, I think the two go hand in hand. So the specific sanction that was imposed in this case was exclusion of specific exhibits, not dismissal of entire claims, not dismissal of appellant's case, but exclusion of two specific exhibits that, frankly, appellant had been put on notice could be excluded. The amount, sure, is significant, but as far as I'm aware in completing research, I have not seen indication that there is a line relative to an amount which the district court must weigh sanctions against to determine an appropriate discovery sanction.
Well, let's talk then about your focus now is on the sanction regarding the non-disclosure, but related, of course, is the conduct-based attorney's fees. So how clearly can we tell from the district court's decision what exactly the conduct was that justifies the amount of fees that are the sanction?
The district court did not make a specific finding regarding how it reached the amount of fees that it reached.
I think you're right. So my question is then, how do we apply the abuse of discretion standard regarding the amount of of fees, assuming the district court was correct in granting conduct-based fees. How do we assess the court's discretion if we don't know how it reached the amount?
In its finding an order relative to the conduct-based attorney's fees, the court looks at the attorney fee request that was submitted by respondent, which I believe was somewhere in the realm of north of $20,000. I don't recall off the top of my head what the specific amount was. The district court made findings that the court had previously put our appellant on notice that he could be facing additional attorney's fees for failure to comply, noted that the failure to comply with discovery had prevented any meaningful settlement discussion, and ultimately awarded not the full amount the respondent had incurred, but a lesser amount of $10,000.
Well, put differently, how can we tell, and perhaps shouldn't we infer, that this is a duplication of penalties? You've got the you got not going to allow this evidence to be in, which has a financial consequence. It obviously impacts the court's ultimate finding as to the amount. And then on top of it, you have the conduct-based fees. How do we know it's not just a duplication based upon the court's description of the reason for the amount?
Well, the reason for the amount, I would say, is distinct. It's not that the attorney's fees was not strictly a discovery sanction. It wasn't just he didn't provide these documents, period, and now we're dealing with this. The court referenced specifically that there had not been a meaningful exchange of information, had not been a meaningful opportunity for settlement as a result of that exchange of information, which increased the length and expense of the proceeding and resulted in conduct-based attorney's fees. So I think that the issues are certainly connected but distinct in terms of how the court was, the harm that the court found existed as a result.
If we were to rule in your favor, assume that we would provide some description justifying the district court's amount of both in the result of the discovery sanction and the conduct-based fees, help me to understand how we would articulate some connection in the record to the amounts. This amount for, you know, the conduct-based attorney's fees may be covering this as opposed to the result of the sanction.
I'm not entirely sure I understand the question. So
we'll assume we're going to base our decision on recognizing the district court's ability to discern and determine what seems fair and appropriate and reasonable for both these two, the conduct-based fees and the discovery sanction. I assume that we're going to attach some math to it to justify the district court's conclusion as to the amounts and the effect. What would we look to in the record, and what roughly would we say justifies the district court's decision?
For the equity issue, for the home equity issue, I think the amount is, the math is implicit, right? The exhibits that were excluded, that's where the math comes from in terms of what could have been awarded and what was awarded. Mm-hmm. So I think the math specifically with respect to that issue comes from those documents. And so if this court were to find that the district court did not abuse its discretion in excluding those documents, that math is implicit in the documents that were excluded. With respect to the attorney fee award, I would concede that is more difficult. The district court did not include any specific math.
So what was wife's submission in support of the attorney fee award? How detailed was it? I haven't looked at that. I'm sure you have.
To be honest, I was not the attorney who represented respondent at the district court level for the trial court, so I don't know that I could provide accurate information off the top of my head about exactly what was provided.
Thanks.
Based on the district court's findings, I believe that there were attorney fee affidavits provided, totaling, as I said, I don't recall the exact number, but something north of $20,000 for the fees that had been incurred. And so the district court didn't award that whole amount, but found that $10,000 was appropriate. In determining whether a district court abused its discretion by imposing a discovery sanction, this court looks at specific factors. It looks at whether the district court set a specific date for compliance and warned of potential sanctions for noncompliance. It looks at whether the noncompliance was willful or without justification. It looks at whether the noncompliance was an isolated incident or a pattern of part of a pattern. And it looks at whether the moving party demonstrated prejudice. With respect to these factors, the district court twice set out a specific date for compliance for appellants' discovery responses and twice warned of potential sanctions for noncompliance. Among the potential sanctions that the district court warned were specifically exclusion of evidence at trial and a potential additional award of attorney's fees and costs. And despite being put on specific notice that he could be facing these exact consequences, appellant failed to comply and is now arguing that he should not have had to face the consequences that he was previously put on notice of. With respect to the second factor, the district court found that appellant was willfully noncompliant. Specifically, the district court stated, "I don't understand what I could have done or what Ms. Minnick could have done more during this proceeding to make Mr. Denny comply with the discovery responses. These documents in particular," the district court said, "seem to be fairly easy to come by, so I'm going to exclude 205 and 206 and grant the motion in limine."
To what extent, if any, should we consider or apply appellant's argument that the court should have, at least implicit argument, the court should have explored the possibility that the sanction was really for conduct of the attorney as opposed to Mr. Denny directly?
I think prior to the court's issuance of the second order to compel discovery, Mr. Denny filed an affidavit in response to respondents' motion to compel discovery. In that affidavit, he essentially was asking the court to find that he had provided enough documentation. There was nothing left to provide. So based on the record that I have reviewed, I don't see that it was the conduct of the attorney.
Would it matter?
You know, I'm not sure that it would, because attorneys are authorized to act on behalf of their client, and there'd be other avenues for relief if Mr. Denny felt that his attorney had taken some action contrary to his interests. But even if it did matter, Mr. Denny submitted sworn statements essentially indicating he wouldn't provide additional discovery. With respect to the encumbrance on the truck, while it was undisputed that appellant's truck did have an encumbrance, the district court did not have any verification of the amount owed on the truck. Appellant did provide testimony regarding the encumbrance, but in his testimony he indicated that there was an encumbrance of, I think the quote is, "I would say probably about 40-some thousand dollars." So all the district court had was appellant's rough estimate with no verification of an amount, and respondent testified that she was not aware of what the amount was because, again, she had not received documentation that had been requested relative to that amount. So respondent would submit that the district court did not abuse its discretion in declining to calculate an equity in the truck based solely on appellant's rough estimate without any evidence to verify and without even an exact number coming from appellant in his testimony. And finally, the district court did not abuse its discretion by concluding that the debt incurred during the marriage was marital debt and treating it accordingly as part of the property division. Under Minnesota law, debt is apportionable as part of the marital property settlement, and the court properly divided, treated.
Was there any evidence in the record I mean, that would have suggested that there was no encumbrance on the truck?
No.
I mean, given the part of the ML. All right, thank you.
And that's my time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And Mr. Lesh, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am limited as to what I am able to argue regarding whose fault it was about the failure to disclose. I'm limited to the record and the transcript. Counsel is correct that appellant may have other recourse based upon how this appeal was filed and when, and the fact that there was no motion for post-judgment relief. But I think it could be fairly construed, based on what we know in the record, that appellant did have these documents because they were ultimately disclosed before trial, and that perhaps he just did not understand, based on communication, what was necessary if he thought he had disclosed everything and that he hadn't.
We can't, though, as you are, I'm gathering, listening between the words, that we can't base our decision on what might have happened outside the record as to who might be responsible other than your client.
Your Honor, yes, that is true. You can't base your decision on anything outside the record, but I think it's notable that what wasn't produced was not attempts to hide value. It was failure to disclose encumbrances, which only could be construed against appellant. There is no way that failure to produce evidence of an encumbrance on asset which is going to be awarded to him would have any negative effect against anyone but him. So I would ask you to, I guess, make that inference that if there was a failure, that it was not necessarily intentional on the part of appellant.
But that would be in the face of the district court's finding that it was intentional.
Your Honor, yes, which is another reason why we think this was an abuse of discretion. We think the evidence suggests that that finding should not have been made.
And what's the standard of review on the finding of intentionality?
Your Honor, I don't have that in front of me right now. I feel like I'm a 1L, but I'll know it next time, I promise you that. But I'll say this, the total penalties imposed here are $117,901.23. That is the missing encumbrance, or that is the missing difference in equity of the homes, plus the half of the $40,000 equity in the pickup truck, plus the $10,000 attorney's fees finding. That is just really significant for a mistake, whosever fault it was, and that's why we're maintaining that this is an abuse of discretion. I would also ask that you take into consideration that the trial court, stated that it had no way of knowing how much of a lopsided award this was going to be, when it absolutely had at its disposal how much of a lopsided award it could be, because that was evident based on inferences that were either easily before it, number one, or in evidence in Exhibits 205 and 206 that it just summarily decided to discard. It was within its rights to impose discovery sanctions, but when these discovery sanctions add up to $117,000, we maintain that that was an abuse of discretion. And that's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. This matter is now submitted to the court for a decision. We very much appreciate the opportunity to hear from counsel today, and we will issue a written decision within the statutory timeline. Thank you.